but it wasn't by some grand decree. It's like trying to explain why nobody saw. Once everyone started to see that the world was much smaller than ever before, and over there wasn't so far anymore. What we did unto others washed up on our shore. The answer was hard to ignore. The end of war. The end of war.
Good evening and welcome to Peace Talk, a production by the Juneau Chapter of Veterans for Peace for KTOO Radio's Focus on Community. This is VFP's contribution to our community's ongoing conversation about war and peace and the important issues and questions they raise in our society and around the world. I'm Rich Moniak. Tonight's program will revisit the Gulf of Tonkin incidents from August 1964 and the subsequent congressional resolution that led to the tragic escalation of the Vietnam War. The discussion you will hear with Norman Solomon was recorded at the KTOO studio with the help of Jeff Brown on August 8th. Norman began his career as a journalist in the 1980s. From 1992 to 2009, he wrote a nationally syndicated column known as Media Beat. He is the author of more than a dozen books. His most recent is Made Love, Got War, Close Encounters with America's Warfare State. His 2005 book, War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death, was made into a documentary film in 2007. He's also written several books about problems with reporting in the mainstream media. He is the founder of three important nonprofit organizations, including the Institute for Public Accuracy, which is dedicated to helping grassroots organizations expand public policy debates by working to get their ideas into the mainstream media. RootsAction.org is an online initiative dedicated to galvanizing Americans who are committed to economic fairness, equal rights, civil liberties, environmental protection, and defunding endless wars. And launched in June of this year, ExposeFacts.org, which aims to shed light on concealed activities, whether governmental or corporate, that the public has a right to know. And so, let's move on to our discussion with Norman Solomon. The Gulf of Tonkin incident occurred 50 years ago this month. President Lyndon Johnson and Secretary of State Robert McNamara told Congress and the American people that the North Vietnamese had twice attacked U.S. warships on routine patrol in international waters, that the evidence for the second attack, like the first, was unequivocal, and the attack had been unprovoked, and that the United States had no intentions to widen the war. The President sought from Congress the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, the very first line which read, to promote the maintenance of international peace and security in Southeast Asia. It would authorize the President to take all necessary measures to repel any armed attack against forces of the United States and to prevent further aggression, to take all necessary steps, including the use of armed forces, to assist South Vietnam in defense of its freedom. The resolution would remain in effect until the President determined that peace and security of the area is reasonably assured or until Congress terminated by concurrent resolution. The House of Representatives voted unanimously in support of the resolution. The vote in Senate was 88-2 in favor. Two senators who opposed it were Wayne Morse of Oregon and Alaska's Ernest Greening. Both of those senators lost their re-election bid 4 years later. We know today that the second attack never occurred. What we're here to discuss this evening, what really happened in the Gulf, what transpired behind the scenes that Congress and the public were never told, what was the U.S. media role and effectiveness in reporting the events, and what lessons have we learned or failed to learn from this incident. So with that, let's jump to the first question with our guest, Norman Solomon. Norman, tell us what really happened.
Well, as far as we know, the first attack did take place on U.S. Ships, although there is still some controversy about that. But even Secretary of State, rather Secretary of Defense, McNamara has since acknowledged that there was no second attack. And that's quite stunning when you step back and realize that the whole rationale or pretext for the Gulf of Tonkin resolution and the U.S. bombing of North Vietnam that quickly ensued was that there had been a second attack. You know, I'm looking at a headline, the Washington Post, dated August 5th, 1964, that refers to second attack on our destroyers, move taken to halt new aggression. That is from the Washington Post headline. And the front page of the New York Times reported, President, I'm quoting here, President Johnson has ordered retaliatory action against gunboats and certain supporting facilities in North Vietnam after renewed attacks against American destroyers in the Gulf of Tonkin. So essentially, the American public, and that included Congress, were told that all this escalation by the United States was made necessary by attacks on U.S. Vessels that actually never occurred. One thing I do want to mention, Rich, before I forget, which is something I learned from Daniel Ellsberg when I was working on my book, War Made Easy, and that is that actually, eventually, we were told that the North Vietnamese Navy had been shelling the North Vietnamese coast prior to what we now know as the Gulf of Tonkin incident. But Dan Ellsberg has pointed out that actually even that was a cover story because it wasn't just a matter of the South Vietnamese Navy shelling, attacking, bombing the North Vietnamese coast before the Gulf of Tonkin incident, but in fact the U.S. military had been bombing North Vietnamese coast before this incident. So it's not as though this was whatever did occur during this first reported attack. It's not as though it was in any way unprovoked. It was, in fact, the U.S. military that had done the provoking.
Well, Norman, can you back up just a second? You mentioned Daniel Ellsberg giving you this information. Where was Daniel Ellsberg while this was going on?
Well, he had just reported for duty for the U.S. government at the Pentagon when all this came down, as I recall. So he, as a U.S. official, of course, he had been part of sort of the brain trust analyzing what was going on in Vietnam. He was to continue into 65 and then the latter part of the 1960s. As a important U.S. government official, he was sometimes literally at the side of Secretary of Defense McNamara, and he tried in his own mind to help the situation get to a better place, and eventually, as we know, came to decide that the war was immoral from the beginning, that as Daniel Ellsberg was later to say, it wasn't that the United States government was on the wrong side in the Vietnam War. In fact, he came to decide the U.S. government was the wrong side in the Vietnam War.
So he was in the Pentagon as these events were unfolding, and so essentially he's given a firsthand account of what happened.
Well, yes, of course, he didn't know all this at the time. He did later discover a great deal. And eventually, of course, released the Pentagon Papers in 1971.
So he didn't know it at the time. When the reports came into the Secretary of Defense, to his assistants, to the president, essentially, what were they saying? Was it clear from the beginning that the second attack had occurred? Was that the impression they had? Were there any doubts?
Well, you know, I can't speak to what was, there were some doubts, even in official circles. But the official story was that these North Vietnamese torpedo boats had launched what was repeatedly called an unprovoked attack on a U.S. destroyer, which was described as being on routine patrol in the Gulf of Tonkin on August 2nd, and then a reputed deliberate attack on a pair of U.S. Ships 2 days later. But in fact, the destroyer, that U.S. destroyer that was attacked on purported routine patrol on August 2nd was actually involved in very aggressive intelligence gathering maneuvers in sync with, in coordination with attacks by the U.S. South Vietnamese forces. As a matter of fact, the scholar Daniel Hallin at the University of California in San Diego has written, and I'm quoting here, the day before, that is the day before August 2nd, the first reported attack, two attacks on North Vietnam had taken place. They were, again quoting Professor Hallin, part of a campaign of increasing military pressure on the North that the United States had been pursuing since early 1964. Now, the Gulf of Tonkin incidents occurred in August of 1964. So you had a situation where the Pentagon on the night of August 4th declared that there had been a second attack by these North Vietnamese PT boats earlier in the day. And then Lyndon Johnson, the President of the United States, went on national TV that evening announcing what turned out to be a momentous escalation of the war, which is to say airstrikes against North Vietnam. And again, it was this motif that it was all about retaliating against an attack that, in fact, never happened. And, you know, you began, Rich, our discussion here by, you know, what has been learned or not learned. And I think what we have seen so often in the 50 years since 1964 is repeatedly the dissembling, the deception, the lies of omission and commission, sometimes out of the ignorance, but usually just willful deception or bending of truth, coming from top officials in the White House and the Pentagon and the State Department to justify further wars. We had just the year after the Gulf of Tonkin incident, we had the invasion of the Dominican Republic. We've had just many U.S. invasions since then, Panama, Grenada, Afghanistan, of course, Iraq, many other U.S. military actions. And when you hold up those actions to the light of day, as you know, I did in my book War Made Easy, and many scholars have done, we see that deception and outright lies, unfortunately, formed the basis of the excuses and rationales and public explanations from top officials in Washington to try to justify going into war and repeatedly engaging in huge military activities.
So that's coming out of the administrations, the Pentagon, the military complex. Congress, where was Congress? Were they informed of the operations that were going on that the Navy was conducting prior to these incidents?
Well, apparently not. And Dan Ellsberg has said that he was told by Senator Wayne Morris, who, as you mentioned, along with Alaska Senator Ernest Greening, was one of the two courageous senators to vote against the Tonkin Gulf resolution. Morris later told Dan Ellsberg that if he had known the realities, if he had known what was in the Pentagon Papers in 1964, he would have thought that most senators would have refused to approve the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. Now, we don't want to let senators and members of Congress off the hook. They should have, they could have raised questions and voted against this resolution, but they did not raise those questions and overwhelmingly approved. People might say, well, gee, you know, that was 50 years ago, things have changed, but you can go to September 14th, 2001, where the entire Senate, but all but one member of the U.S. House of Representatives, California's Congresswoman Barbara Lee, voted overwhelmingly for what is still being invoked, the authorization for use of military force. That has been a fig leaf excuse for U.S. warfare in Afghanistan, in Iraq, which we now know from just the last few days, again, U.S. bombing of Iraq. All this is continuing, and you have a dynamic of officials in top positions in the executive branch lying to the public, lying to the news media overwhelmingly being willing to dutifully report those deceptions as fact, and then members of Congress making it easy for themselves to cite those deceptions as facts, to cast votes and through sins of omission and commission, send U.S. soldiers, men and women, to kill and be killed for reasons that are based on absolute falsehoods. And of course, the people of Afghanistan and Iraq in huge numbers have suffered terrible consequences.
And they did in Vietnam as well, much more so.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, we hear, and we should, about the 58,000 U.S. soldiers who died as a direct result of the Vietnam War, let alone many others who have died as a consequence in the later decades. And we should always acknowledge and grieve over their deaths, at the same time recognizing that so many Vietnamese people were killed, several million of them were killed ultimately by this war in Vietnam that never should have been fought in the first place.
So had Congress debated this issue, I mean, as they should have, it was not an authorization for war, which falls under the purview of Congress's responsibility to declare war. It was a resolution to use force similar to what we did in Iraq. Congress should have debated this. And would any of this information have come out? I mean, there obviously wasn't an urgency to retaliate. It had already happened, as a matter of fact, by the time the president spoke. Is that not right?
Right, right. It already happened or allegedly happened.
So Congress has a responsibility to debate these issues rigorously, and they failed. And the press fails to hold anybody accountable. What are the American people supposed to do?
Well, Congress does have that responsibility, rarely fulfilled. And what the American people need to do, whether we live in Alaska or anywhere else, is to raise hell about it, to speak up, to be informed, and to insist that it's not acceptable for members of Congress to sleepwalk into dragging us into one war after another with terrible consequences for people who live in the attacked country. You know, you're asking about the role as well, again, of Congress, which is so crucial. If we go back to the history of what occurred in early August of 1964, you know, 2 days after the second supposed incident in the Gulf of Tonkin, on August 6th, the Secretary of Defense, McNamara, testified at a joint closed session of the Foreign Relations Committee of the Senate and the Armed Services Committee of the Senate. And we now know, I've got the document right here, that McNamara said that the two U.S. vessels, the Turner Joy and the Maddox, and I'm quoting, returned the fire, unquote, that had been directed at them in the form of torpedoes and automatic weapons fire. And he was flanked by this General Earl Wheeler, and he spun it out. And when a senator asked how many of their torpedoes were set in motion and what small arms were used, I want to quote what Secretary of Defense McNamara told the Congress. He said, quote, "It is difficult to estimate. This was a very dark night. The attack was carried out during the night, the hours of darkness. It was a premeditated attack, a pre-planned attack. It was described as an ambush in the reports from the commanders, but because it was night, it is very difficult to estimate the total amount of fire," unquote. Well, McNamara went on to absolutely flatly say that these shots that were believed to have taken place were absolutely initiated by the North Vietnamese forces. And what we've got is a situation where the lies became a chain of lies. And in fact, most people in the United States, I think, sincerely at the beginning believed those lies, and we see the consequences.
Well, and McNamara obviously, you know, has the ear of the president. He was very influential in Congress in that particular hearing with the Senate. But it would be, 35 years later in his book, In Retrospect, when he began to, I mean, as you mentioned earlier, for all indications, the first attack did occur. And that's not as disputed, even though some people still question it, as the second attack. In retrospect, McNamara says it was probable. And then later, sometime in this century, in the documentary film Fog of War, he flat out says it didn't happen.
You're talking about the second attack?
The second attack, correct?
Yes, yes. He flat out says there was no second attack. You know, on this note, I think, you know, even if there was a first attack, let's stipulate, okay, there was a first attack. It was not an unprovoked incident or unprovoked attack. You know, I want to cite here a comment that came two decades later from the journalist Stanley Carnot, who wrote factually a somewhat definitive book about the Vietnam War. This is the reporting from Stanley Carnot. He said, early in the morning, and this is when the testimony came 2 days after the alleged second attack from Secretary McNamara, early in the morning, a Pentagon officer called a startling tip to Senator Wayne Morse. The officer, whose identity Morse would never divulge, revealed that the Maddox had indeed been involved in the covert South Vietnamese raids against North Vietnam. But then, Carnot goes on to report, when Senator Morse raised that issue, Defense Secretary McNamara just flat out lied. He said, quote, our Navy played absolutely no part in, was not associated with, was not aware of any South Vietnamese actions, if there were any. I say this flatly, this is a fact, unquote. Well, it actually was a flat-out lie. And that, you know, goes, I think, to this dynamic, and it is as recent as the Obama administration, but goes back to many previous ones, where you've got officials, even under oath, going to Capitol Hill in public session and closed sessions, making statements that are absolutely false and that they know are false. And partly to lean on that, the members of the Senate and House then say, well, I've been assured of X, Y, and Z. I have to vote this way. I can't challenge policy. We should remember that the Director of Intelligence for the U.S. government, James Clapper, testified just a bit over a year ago to Congress saying that the NSA, the National Security Agency, doesn't spy on any Americans at all. And it's in retrospect what we know now from the documents provided by Edward Snowden, that was not only a lie, it was an absurd 180 from actual fact. So it gets back to your quandary that you pose in a way of how do we understand what happened with the Gulf of Tonkin events 50 years later and what have we or not learned from those events?
Well, was the Senate aware of these covert acts, and was it the Navy running them? Was it the CIA? Was it a collaborative effort?
Well, evidently, they were not aware. I mean, Senator Morse was aware and then called it to the attention and confronted the Secretary of Defense in a hearing, closed hearing on this during this pivotal couple of days. But basically, most to all members of Congress, with very few exceptions, were not aware at that time. Now, I should say that if we look at the last couple of years and NSA surveillance and the last dozen years in terms of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, there has been some knowledge by members of the Senate and House intelligence committees and so forth that they just keep quiet about. And in the case of, say, Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, they've been very unhappy about their supposed obligation under classification system to be quiet about things that they know are false. As a matter of fact, when Clapper was testifying falsely a little over a year ago, Wyden pushed him because he knew that Clapper was lying, and Clapper just continued to lie.
So, and he had no ability to bring that out because he was sworn to secrecy.
Well, that's a key point. Under the rules of the Senate, you're on the Senate Intelligence Committee, House Intelligence Committee, or you just happen to be a member of the House and Senate. You are sworn to promise that you won't divulge so-called intelligence information. And, you know, legally, you could do that. You're a member of the House and Senate, but you would be totally ostracized and you wouldn't see anything again. And unfortunately, we have tremendous cowardice in the House and Senate. Now, let me give a shout-out and pay tribute to another U.S. senator from the state of Alaska. We've talked about Ernest Greening, who, like Senator Morse, took tremendous abuse for his visionary wisdom of voting against the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. But it was less than 10 years later when Senator Mike Gravel from Alaska courageously took the Pentagon Papers and read them, proceeded to read parts of them into the Congressional Record and to release them in the Congressional Record. And Mike Gravel was a real hero. The good news and bad news is that we have had and continue to have very, very few members of the House and Senate of the United States Congress willing or able to provide the kind of courage that the Senators Morrison, Greening, and Gravel have provided to this country.
And Barbara Lee, as you mentioned earlier.
Yes, indeed.
Yes. So going back to the Gulf of Tonkin, when did it begin to unravel that the administration had withheld information or hadn't fully informed Congress, that there were doubts about what happened, and who took the lead on divulging that information?
Well, as so often happens, it unravels in stages and in different quarters. I mean, if you read I.F. Stone's Weekly at the time, it began to unravel immediately. If you read only and relied on a place like the New York Times and Washington Post, you may not have learned it till the early 1970s. And the Pentagon Papers came out and so forth, and it was possible then to learn more. When I was working on a book, about 10 years ago, a book which became War Made Easy, I went back to find the editorials and the coverage of the Gulf of Tonkin events in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the L.A. Times. And, of course, the front page and the editorial pages were essentially the same. They all assumed that there was this unprovoked aggression from North Vietnam and the U.S. had to start bombing North Vietnam overtly and escalating the war. But I called the reporter, Murray Marder, who had written the front page news story about the Gulf of Tonkin incidents right then in the middle of this. And he said that he had been aware because there had been tiny news coverage of South Vietnamese Navy engaging in some sort of military activity along the or at the North Vietnamese coast. And he said to me, and I quote this in the War Made Easy book, that he felt uneasy about it at the time. And here was the leading diplomatic correspondent for the Washington Post, Murray Marder. But as he told me, he wanted to go back and dig into it. But then the train, he saw very quickly, was leaving the station. His own newspaper, like virtually every major newspaper in the country, editorialized that the U.S. had to bomb North Vietnam and respond against this supposed aggression by the North Vietnamese. And at that point, Murray Marder said, well, I read the editorials, I saw the news coverage, I saw what Congress did in passing the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, and it just seemed like, and I'm paraphrasing here, but this was the gist of what he was saying, it just seemed like the train had left the station. The horse was out of the barn. And so this is the way it happens. And in its own way, what happened more than 10, 12 years ago with the story about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. You had the herd instinct, the journalists, the members of the House and Senate who go along to get along. They don't want to be accused of being unpatriotic or unwilling for the U.S. government to deal firmly with the enemy du jour, the enemy of the decade, the communists, the terrorists, whatever it might be.
Well, that brings two questions to mind. You touched upon the patriotic, the patriot element of the Congress and writers, and I know firsthand, you know, having become an anti-war activist during the Iraq War, what it's like to question the government and be called un-American. So my first question is, was that going on? And the second question goes back to, so if the train's leaving the station, it leaves pretty quickly. And it seems like the media, you know, not following the events in Vietnam at that time very closely, weren't educated enough to raise enough questions early on, and they just shrugged their shoulders and let the train go.
Well, for a lot of the same reasons, just the general public, and for that matter, senators on the one hand, and journalists with mainline media outlets on the other, were very intimidated. A lot of them just instinctively wanted to be with the majority that had strength at the time. And others just, you know, they feared for their jobs, their careers. They had all sorts of conscious and unconscious reasons for going along with the dominant claims and the line coming out of the offices of the war makers, in effect. So people could have asked questions. Some people did. And one of the great fears, of course, was being called unpatriotic, even being called sympathetic to communists back 50 years ago or sympathetic to terrorism today. Totally absurd, but people don't like to be the target of that kind of denunciation. And when you look at what requires real courage, it is so often socially, politically, economically, to be a dissenter. Because we now know, for instance, that those who spoke out against the war in Iraq as the U.S. invasion of that country was being prepared, they had it right. If their views had prevailed, which you know, included my views at the time, and I went to Baghdad three times before the invasion in efforts to try to find alternatives to that invasion, but if our collective efforts had been heeded, then we'd have so many people in this country and so many vastly more people in Iraq who would be alive today, who have passed away because of this confluence of lies and militarism.
Well, I want to take a moment here and just remind listeners that you're listening to KTOO in Juneau. Right now I'm going to play a song that Jeff Brown suggested. It's Country Joe McDonald singing live at Woodstock in 1969.
Well, come on, all of you big strong men. Uncle Sam needs your help again. Got himself in a terrible jam way down yonder in Vietnam. Put down your books and pick up a gun. We're going to have a whole lot of fun. And it's one, two, three. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. The next stop is Vietnam. Well, there ain't no time to wonder why we're all gonna die. Now come on, Wall Street, don't be slow. Why, man, this is war, a go-go. There's plenty of good money to be made supplying the army with the tools of the trade. Just so we're afraid that if they drop the bomb, we're dropping on the Viet Cong. And it's one, two, three. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Our next stop is Vietnam. Open up the pearly gates. Well, ain't no time to wonder why we're all gonna die. Now come on, generals, let's move fast. Your big chance is here at last. Now you can go out and get those reds, cause the only good commie is one that's dead. And you know the chiefs can only be one when they're blowing all the kingdom. Come sing it! One, two, three. What are we fighting for?
That was Country Joe McDonald, live asking the crowd at Woodstock, what are we fighting for? Well, as we know now, the Vietnam War was largely fought for a lie told by President Johnson and his Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara. They told Congress and the American people that our Navy was attacked twice in international waters when, in fact, the second attack never happened and the first was provoked by covert operations against North Vietnam by our military. Now, back to our discussion with Norman Solomon about those events and the lessons we haven't learned. We're discussing the Gulf of Tonkin incident and resolution with Norman Solomon, who is the founder of the Institute for Public Accuracy, Roots Action, and a very new organization, ExposeFacts.org. And Norman's written several books and has been a journalist since the early 80s. So, War Made Easy was your book. Both of these wars were made easy by a compliant media, as a media that bends over backwards sometimes to report official story, a media that doesn't do its research, a media that seems to be foundering in more modern times due to lack of funds. Your organizations, you know, that you started are an attempt to correct some of these things. Is that right?
Yes, it's very important for us, no matter what issues and areas we are at work in, to not be defeatist, to realize that we can make a big difference. And as you mentioned, I founded the Institute for Public Accuracy now 17 years ago, and we recently have launched an ongoing project called ExposeFacts.org, which encourages whistleblowing. We're a journalistic organization, and we have a secure drop system for people who might have information and documents that can be provided as much as feasible in this NSA world anonymously. We have state-of-the-art software technology where we won't know who has sent us the material. And so people can learn more, including see a video about our organization from one of our advisory board members, Daniel Ellsberg. They can just, everybody's invited to go to exposefacts.org. Also at rootsaction.org, we're sort of an action arm, and we're very concerned with a lot of these issues. You'll find at the top of the website concerns such as the way in which the U.S. government is the main supplier of weapons to the world. And we're basically on that issue saying enough is enough, you know, enough is too much, and let's stop the U.S. government and our country being this huge peddler and provider of weaponry to countries all over the world.
Well, and we are, and that's when I read the first line of the resolution for the Gulf of Tonkin, it just the fact that it mentions peace. It says to promote the maintenance of international peace and security. I mean, that's such a contradiction, and it's so blatantly put out there. You know, in light of what we've talked about, that we were conducting covert operations in against North Vietnamese, that the U.S. Navy was doing just that it wasn't unprovoked attacks. Where's the peace in that?
And unfortunately, Rich, I think that is such a paradigm. It's so key for us to unpack that and see it in historic context because it is as current as today, this pattern when members of the House and Senate who are pushing for war when the President of the United States is doing so, it is routine for them to say that they want to bomb, attack, and invade in order to promote peace. And remember that the mantra from President Nixon as he escalated the Vietnam War even further with tremendous suffering and death inflicted on people in Vietnam. Nixon talked about what he called peace with honor. And so I think we need to recognize that it's easy for anyone to say peace, and we really need to look way beneath that rhetoric to look at the reality.
Well, and I mean, just the past month, we've witnessed a reality in Gaza with Israel and America providing weapons to Israel in that attack.
Well, that is the reality where the United States government may, out of the White House and State Department, say some things about how, oh, you know, we want to bring a ceasefire in terms of what's happening in Gaza and so forth. But meanwhile, the U.S. government has been supplying, as you allude to, massive quantities of weapons and intelligence assistance to Israel as it has continued to periodically bomb and kill vast numbers in that population of civilians, hundreds and hundreds of them children. So the rhetoric is one thing, but we have had, again this summer, the continued U.S. military, economic, and intelligence support for the Israeli government manifested in slaughtering large numbers of civilians who live in Gaza.
Very large numbers in a way that, you know, we're supposed to be the honest peace brokers to not only end the conflict, the immediate conflict, but to bring peace to the Middle East.
Well, yes, it's easy to say that there is a peace process. We've heard that for decades from top officials in Washington, but it's really a misnomer. And this occupation has gone on close to 50 years, and there's no end in sight. It can only change if U.S. government policy changes.
Well, and one of the things that should help that change, which we don't seem to do very well, is hold officials accountable. I mean, if we look at Vietnam, Robert McNamara, you know, the Gulf of Tonkin incident was 1964. In the early 90s, he publishes a book called In Retrospect, which a lot of people felt he was, believed he was, you know, trying to make amends or apologize, make his legacy a little cleaner. But by the time, it seems to me, by the time the real facts come out, and people start to become aware of it, all the players are either too old to prosecute or gone. Is that what we can expect from Iraq, that, you know, 30 years from now we'll be looking back and you know, in the news or in print crucifying, so to speak, the players in that, but not do anything in the interim?
Well, it's all too easy after the fact for semi-apologies to come out, and it really doesn't bring anybody's life back. For those who have been maimed, it doesn't bring their limbs back. So I have a very jaundiced view of these supposed apologies or semi-apologies, and we really have gotten very little by that from top officials, for instance, in terms of the Iraq War, with names like Rumsfeld and Powell and Wolfowitz. They have not apologized. But even if the sort of very belated semi-sort of apology transpires, as eventually happened with Robert McNamara, and frankly it wasn't much of an apology, it's really just way too late. And the only meaningful action of those who are involved and complicit in these illegitimate and terrible wars is when they are willing to do the kind of thing that Daniel Ellsberg did eventually, later than he now says he wished he did, with the Pentagon Papers, and that's to release them. Or, say, Chelsea Manning, or, say, Edward Snowden. These are folks who are whistleblowers and willing and able to provide to the American people information that we have a right to. And that's actually, to get back to exposefacts.org for a moment, that's why we have set up this organization, exposefacts.org, because whistleblowers are a very important link for democracy with the public's right to know, and we need to protect them, defend them, and get more whistleblowers to help democracy actually function.
Well, and Daniel Ellsberg, I believe you installed a billboard near the State Department with a quote from him. And I'd like you to share that.
That's right. ExposedFacts.org has put up billboards near the State Department and other federal agencies in Washington, D.C. And in that, and people can go to our website at ExposedFacts.org, but on that billboard, Daniel Ellsberg says, don't do what I did. Don't wait until thousands more have died. Don't wait for the next war. He says you may save a war's worth of lives if you provide information to the public that they have a right to know. And I think that's a very important message, not only for Washington, D.C., but for California and Oregon and Washington and Alaska and throughout our country. There's a necessity that we take responsibility as citizens for the flow of information and disclosure of information. The way I would put it is our country is based on the informed consent of the governed. If the consent of the governed is not informed, then it's not meaningful consent. And we need information to make basic decisions.
Well, and Daniel Ellsberg, as you read that quote, obviously he was in the Pentagon in 1964. He learned a lot between that period of time and the time he released the Pentagon Papers. That's all covered in his book, Secrets. And I'd like to suggest to listeners, if you want to read his account of the Gulf of Tonkin incident, PBS has a website that they put out when the documentary about Daniel was released. I believe it's called The Most Dangerous Man in America. And they have the entire first chapter is dedicated to the Gulf of Tonkin incident, and it's all easy to read on the Internet at a PBS website.
Yeah, I really do want to echo that and urge people to get a hold of Daniel Ellsberg's book. It's a one-word title, Secrets. A great book, and also, as you mentioned, the documentary which did air on PBS, The Most Dangerous Man in America. I'm sure it's on Netflix, it's in libraries, and it is online.
Yeah, and El, if you read, to me, when I read that book, I think the most fascinating part was when and how long it took once he realized he needed to do something. He agonized over it. It was not an easy decision for him. It was a fascinating personal journey on how to, you know, step out of the role he was in, where he was not directly lying for the government, but complicit in it by his silence.
And this is very common with whistleblowers generally. They tend to really believe in what they're doing, and gradually, or sometimes there's sort of the straw that is the breaking point on the camel's back, they decide that in good conscience they can't continue.
I guess having Ellsberg in this organization, exposeflax.org, that is clearly an invitation for someone who was successful. But his success as a whistleblower was in question. I mean, he faced prison time.
Oh, well, absolutely. He faced more than 100 years in prison in terms of a sentence, and because of government misconduct, there was a mistrial, and he didn't end up serving time in prison. There are other people, of course, who were not so fortunate. Chelsea Manning, serving 35 years, I don't think deserves a moment in prison. Edward Snowden would be facing a similar fate if the U.S. government could get its hands on him. Unfortunately, he's in political asylum in about the only country that was possible now that the U.S. government has taken away his passport, which is Russia. This is very important, and I think we need to create a different political and ethical climate so that whistleblowing is not punished, it's praised.
Well, I think we're about running out of time, Norman. I really appreciate the organizations you've set up to do these things. I've got a question, though, from the public perspective. The informed consent that we're supposed to give, where is our effort best laid? I mean, should we be pressuring Congress to do a better job, or should we be pressuring the media to pressure Congress to do a better job? The media is supposed to be Congress's watchdog. Should we be trusting the media or pushing them a lot harder and let them be the ones to change Congress's behavior?
Well, there's a lot of different parts of the garden to be digging in, and I think working politically and pressuring members of Congress and working to get better people in Congress is part of the process, as well as challenging media, pushing for better, more thorough, and deeper coverage. That's important as well, whether it's challenging the daily newspapers and radio stations to report more fully with more diversity of sources and not simply providing stenography for the powerful, or whether it's building independent media outlets. That's all really very useful, because the aggregate of those efforts really can make a difference.
And what's the role of the Internet? I mean, there's a lot of talk about the Internet freedom today. I can't remember what the phrase is, but the Internet has changed a lot of possible actions for people and the information we get. What do we need to do to keep that intact?
Well, it's certainly to demand the members in Senate and House to fight for net neutrality so there isn't a fast and slow lane on the Internet. At least we now have more of an even playing field. And to utilize it in our own ways, you know, in many ways, people in Alaska are very fortunate because you have two senators and relatively few people compared to many states. So you make a big difference, and your voice can make a big difference in terms of what is said and done or not said or done in the U.S. Senate. And that means really making an effort to inform yourself on the issues and then organize and make a difference and let your voice be heard.
And hopefully, if we do this, we won't have an incident like 1964 or again in 2002 and 3.
That would be the hope. And there are a lot of children and people around the world who are depending on us. So we have a lot of work to do.
We sure do. Well, I want to thank you for joining us, Norman. It's been an enlightening interview for me. And I wish you the best with your organizations because I believe they're vitally important to us.
Well, thank you so much.
You've just heard a pre-recorded discussion with Norman Solomon about the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution from 1964. Now, you may be wondering why we're looking back half a century when we've got compelling problems facing us right now. Well, in the 2008 National Defense Authorization Act, the Secretary of Defense was authorized to develop programs commemorating the 50th anniversary of the Vietnam War. Its five objectives are to thank and honor veterans of the Vietnam War, including personnel who were held prisoners of war or listed as missing in action, for their service and sacrifice on behalf of the United States, and to thank and honor the families of these veterans. To highlight the service of armed forces during the Vietnam War and the contributions of federal agencies and governmental and non-governmental organizations that served with or in support of our armed forces. To pay tribute to the contributions made on the home front by the people of the United States during the Vietnam War. To highlight the advances in technology, science, and medicine related to military research conducted during the Vietnam War, and to recognize the contributions and sacrifices made by the allies of the United States during the Vietnam War. There is nothing in these objectives that suggests the Pentagon will be conducting a critical historical analysis of the tragic disaster that the war was to the Vietnam people or to the 58,000 American lives sacrificed on the altar of empire. We are supposed to learn from history to prevent repeating it, not by whitewashing it as if lying to ourselves is patriotic. So in that context, I think it's fitting to listen to this song, Silence and Lies, by Emma's Revolution.
Rifle and sharply take aim. rock, Southeast Asia, this city or town. Whether your skin is red, yellow, or brown, or white as a sheet, or black as the night, why are we always so ready to fight? Fighting for freedom, claiming the soil, power, cheap labor, rubber, or oil, raising a child or raising a fist. Will you stand up for your right to resist? So many. Wasn't anyone listening then? Are we listening now? Have we joined the debate? Our Gulf of Time, our Watergate, our 9/11, our own demise. No more silence then, no more silence then, no more silence then.
That was Emma's Revolution, concluding our show, pleading for us all to tolerate no more silence and no more lies. This has been Peace Talk on KTOO-FM in Juneau. I'm Rich Moniak, and I want to thank Jeff Brown for helping me produce tonight's program. I want to thank all of you for tuning in. And I especially want to thank Norman Solomon for taking the time to talk about the historical tragedy remembered as the Gulf of Tonkin, and for all the work he is doing to bring the truth about our government's war-making policies out into the open so that someday, maybe we can put an end to war. Thank you for joining us, and have a wonderful night.
The end of war.